welcome. Let's get started. If people trickle in, great. If they don't, great. Then you guys can like ask a million questions because we're a smaller group. And I might, you know, I'm like up at a podium and it's small, so I might just, you know, I don't know. So we'll see. We'll see how the room, that door for some reason won't open. Oh, thank you. I was trying to prop it open, but there's like nothing to prop it open with. That might. Yeah, I was trying to do it with all my hands full. Hi, welcome. All right. So, welcome. I'm glad that you're joining me, and that while you're here at this nice, relaxing week, hopefully you're coming to listen about anxiety. So, you know, my guess is that either you or someone that you know and care about has experienced anxiety, maybe to a degree that's really challenging and difficult. And so my hope is that there can be, you can get some information today that will help you have a better understanding of what's going on for yourself or your loved one. Because a lot of times if we don't understand what's happening to us, it's so much scarier, it's so much more overwhelming. When we can have more understanding, oftentimes that can relieve some of that fear and that overwhelm. So that's really what I hope for you all today. So just as we get started, I think I need to define some terms. So what do I mean when I say anxiety? Because we can throw that around a lot. One simple way I describe anxiety is that it is fear of the future. There's a difference. Anxiety is a type of fear. But specifically, it's about something that hasn't happened yet. So the metaphor that I often use is if you're hiking in the woods here, where it's really beautiful, and all of a sudden a bear pops out of nowhere and starts chasing you and you're running from it, that's fear. It's happening right now. You are currently being chased and you have fear. If you're walking through the forest and you're thinking, what if a bear starts chasing me? And you feel nervous and kind of on edge about that, that would be anxiety. It's that anticipation that kind of sets it apart from just normal fear. And often, anxiety can look very different for different people. Often it's a feeling of worry or nervousness. And like I said, typically about an imminent event that you know is coming or something with an unknown outcome. So a lot of people talk about the unknown and that being a big source of their anxiety, of just not knowing what's going to happen. Also, anxiety is a normal human emotion. We all experience anxiety at some point in our lives, and to a certain degree, it's normal. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Anxiety and stress actually serve a function because it gets us to get up and do something. A certain level of stress is needed for us to perform well. If we didn't have any worries or stress, we may not get up and go to work, or we may not really try very hard. And so to some degree, it is actually a positive thing. It can help us be more prepared and ready for things. So I don't want to make anxiety a total villain or bad guy. What is difficult is when it becomes either so frequent or so intense that it gets in the way of you living your life the way you want to live it. That's when we have a problem, and that's where you might actually qualify as having an anxiety disorder, which is something that I can diagnose, where you know it's severe enough, it's frequent enough to where it is getting in the way of your functioning. Some people it might be they can't go to school, some people they can't go to work, some people social situations are really hard for them. So that can look a lot of different ways. And you can have a great deal of anxiety and not necessarily have an anxiety disorder. So I'm not really interested in labeling you all and, you know, telling you what your deal is. But I think it's safe to say we've all experienced anxiety, maybe in little ways and bigger ways, because it is stressful to be a human. And we live in a fallen, broken world where there's things that are scary and things that are overwhelming. So it's understandable. So I also want to talk about where does anxiety come from? So what's causing this? And I'm going to talk about two main causes. But I also do want to say that sometimes anxiety, like any other medical issue can have a physiological basis. Same with depression. There are certain medical, physical conditions that can cause and contribute to anxiety. So for some people, that's totally the case. Me not being a medical professional, that's all I'll say about it because that's kind of out of my scope. But I will say that. So oftentimes, if I have a new client and they're having a lot of anxiety, I'll ask them, when was the last time you had a physical? When was the last time you had some blood work done? And sometimes they will go to the doctor and they'll be like, oh, my thyroid is really out of whack. And they get on thyroid medication and their anxiety gets better. So sometimes that is part of it. And sometimes it is created and fueled through our thought life. So I'm going to spend a good amount of time talking about the way we think and how that contributes to our anxiety. And then also sometimes anxiety is involuntary, similarly to when it's a medical issue, but also if it is the response to previous experiences, what I might call traumatic experiences, which again, I will define that for you later. So sometimes anxiety is a trauma response. And a lot of times for people where that's true for them, they don't necessarily know why they're anxious or why they feel so uneasy. They just know that they don't feel right. And so I'm going to talk mainly about our thoughts and how our previous experiences might contribute to our anxiety. And then we'll also look at what does the Bible have to say about this. If you get nothing else from today, I really do. It's an issue that needs to be repented of, but a wound that needs Jesus' healing. And I said briefly in my intro, we can read these passages that talk about not being anxious, and we can feel guilty, we can feel ashamed, we can think, oh, I'm not trusting God enough, like my faith, there's something wrong with my faith, I'm not right with God. While that could be true, it could also not be true. And if you're already struggling with anxiety, you don't need more junk piled on top of that, right? And so even as we're learning, often I tell my clients, hey, let's be curious, not judgmental. So as you're hearing what I'm sharing with you, if things are resonating with you, if questions are coming up for you, I just encourage you and invite you to be curious about it. Like, huh, I wonder what it is about what she just said that fits for me. Like, huh, rather than, oh, dude, there's something wrong with me, I'm a weirdo. No. Let's not judge ourselves. Let's be curious about what's going on. And I also, as I'm talking, I'll kind of go through these different sections and I'll pause for questions before I move on. But if at any time you have a question, please feel free to raise your hand. I'm happy to answer to the best of my abilities. But I definitely don't want to be, if I'm talking and you're like, what is she saying? Please stop me. Because when I get going talking about something that I'm passionate about, I can, you know, get on the treadmill and maybe go a little fast or a little too intense. So please feel free to holler at me if you need me to slow down or you need me to clarify something. Is that good for everyone? Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for the double thumbs up. All right. So let's look at, so what does the Bible say about anxiety? So I'm going to read a few passages. And in different translations, in most of them, here it's all anxiety, but sometimes it's worry. So Philippians, it says, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. I love this passage. We'll go more into practicalities of like, well, what does the Bible say we should do about our anxiety? But it gives us some practical steps. At the same time, we see that opening line, do not be anxious about anything. That's pretty cut and dry. It seems pretty black and white. And so we might be like, oh gosh, I'm not supposed to be anxious. So again, this could create us to be anxious about our anxiety. And just to give context, anytime we're looking at scriptures, it's good to have the context because we can take things out of context and twist them to mean what we want them to mean. So later on, Paul goes on to talk about, you know, what to focus our thoughts on. And he says, you know, whatever is good, whatever is noble, whatever is true, set your mind on these things. So he goes on to talk about the way we think. So that's a little foreshadowing about where I'm going. Another very well-known passage, maybe very familiar to many of you, is in Matthew. Jesus is talking. He says, therefore, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? The Gentiles seek after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. So we think about often this verse a lot where, you know, Jesus says, do not be anxious about your life. Do not be anxious about tomorrow. And so, again, it seems pretty direct, pretty clear. And again, the context for this is right before this. Jesus is talking about our treasure in heaven and how you cannot serve both God and money. So he's talking about not allowing the material of our lives, the material things in our lives, to become our idol, to be what we see as most important. Because here he's saying, you know, there's more than just our food and our clothing. There's a lot more than that. And lastly, this is also Jesus. So in the story where Jesus goes to the home of Mary and Martha, Mary sits at Jesus' feet and listens to him teach, and her sister Martha is trying to be the perfect hostess, running around, getting everything ready for everyone, and Martha is very frustrated that her sister is not helping her, and she tells Jesus, like, tell my sister to help me. And this is Jesus' response. He says, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her. So he's noticing, like, she is anxious and troubled. And so what's very interesting is that in each of these passages, and these are just a few, there are other places where we see worry or anxiety, but these are kind of the most well-known ones. In each of these passages, the word for anxiety or worry is the same Greek word, and it means to be anxious about, like, okay, that's not really anything special or different, to be careful or to take thought. And so that is where I want us to focus. So in the New Testament, at least, when the Bible is talking about anxiety, it is talking about the way we are thinking. So that is so important for us because it is not talking about a medical issue. It is not talking about a trauma response. It is talking about our thoughts. And so it's so important for us to know that, because if our anxiety is based on one of those other two things, we can really beat ourselves up for not being able to change our thoughts and change our anxiety. But if this is where anxiety is coming from, if it is coming from our thoughts, that's great, because we actually do have power and control over the way we think. It takes a little work, it takes some learning, some practice, but we do have control, and I think God knows that. And that's why he gives us the instructions he gives us. So let's look at what are some biblical principles for managing anxiety. So if we go back to the Matthew passage where Jesus is talking, you know, he says, who of you by being anxious can add a single hour to his life? Like, there's a lot of wisdom in that. And it's Jesus. Of course there's wisdom in it. He's so wise. But yeah, just simply recognizing my worry, my anxiety is actually not helping anything. And it's kind of this weird, like, sometimes subconscious thing where there's a part of us that believes if I worry about this, it's helpful. I'm doing something constructive. And that's just not true. It's not. And so first is to recognize that. It doesn't mean your anxiety goes away right away, but just acknowledging, like, my worry is not helping the situation. Me ruminating on all these possible things is not really helping. So oftentimes, a practice that I use and that I share with my clients is to simply ask yourself, whatever it is you're worried about or anxious about, to ask, is there anything I can do about this situation right now. I'm getting married in September, which is super sweet, but wedding planning is so anxiety provoking. I am like slightly anxious, like constantly, because there's so many things in my head. And what I have to do, I actually made a list. I made timelines of, okay, this month I think about these things, this month I think about these things. And I sometimes jump. I've been jumping over to July, and I'm like, wait, I'm not supposed to think about that yet. Come back to June. What do I need to do? And I have to ask myself, is there anything I can do right now? And sometimes the answer is no, and then I have to say, okay, I need to let it go, and kind of going back to that, do not worry about tomorrow. Like, just focus on today. Be present right now. So that's how I kind of use this in my life right now, just being honest. I'm a therapist, and I still have anxiety. But then if there is something I can do, like, yeah, I could email that person. I need to get this question answered. I could call that person, or I can research this online. Then I do it, and then I feel better, because I'm like, okay, I've done something. I don't need to be worrying about it. So again, asking yourself, is there anything I can do about this situation? If yes, do it. And if not, let it go and recognize that your anxiety is doing nothing. And I understand that is easier said than done. For example, I have a lot of friends who've talked about either as soon as they got married or as soon as they had kids, like when your kids go off to school for the first time, a lot of parents are anxious about that, right? Because they don't know what's going to happen. There's all those unknowns. And of course, like I could say, well, there's nothing you can do. You've done everything you could to prepare your child for this moment. You've done great. And now, you know, it's not totally in your hands anymore. So just let it go. Don't worry about it. Like, all parents would probably be like, yeah, you don't have kids. You don't get it, right? Because it's easier said than done. And so I just want to acknowledge that all the things I'm saying, they may not necessarily make all your anxiety go away, but they certainly do lower the level of anxiety. And even telling yourself it's okay, you know, giving yourself that positive self-talk. And so another thing that I ask people to do, especially if there's nothing you can do, but you still can't really let it go, is I actually ask people to play out your worst case scenario. And this does not work in all situations, because sometimes your worst case scenario is actually pretty horrible. So it's not helpful. Some people tend to jump to conclusions, or they always jump to the worst case scenario. Like they already do this, but in a not helpful way. So if that's you, this practice may not work great for you. But in a lot of cases, if you just think about, you know, whatever the situation you're worried about, so maybe your kid's going to kindergarten for the first time, so you're afraid that a kid's going to be mean to him and his feelings are going to get hurt. That's like if I were to ask, what would be the worst thing that could happen today? And that's what you said, like, someone's mean to my kid and he comes home crying and he never wants to go back to school and it's this big thing. Like, okay, so then what would happen? Well, we'd talk about bullying, and we'd, you know, I'd let him cry, and we'd talk it out, and he might not want to go to school the next day, but, you know, I'd probably talk to the teacher and let her know what happened, and da-da-da. Okay, then what would happen? You know, and you keep going, and a lot of times it comes down to, oh, and then it would be fine. Like, yeah, I'd have to deal with it, but it would be fine. Like, my world is not going to end. So a lot of times, our worries in our head are like Mount Everest, and then when we say it out loud, it's this little pebble. And not always. So I do want to acknowledge that. Not always, but I'd say the majority of the time, we make things a lot bigger in our heads than they actually are in real life. And that's a huge thing about therapy. People are just saying things out loud that they've never said out loud before, that have just been in their head, and they'll say it out loud, and they're like, oh, that's not that bad. And I'm like, yeah. But when it's just in our head, it just becomes bigger and bigger. So again, so asking, is there anything I can do about this? And if not, what's your worst case scenario? And just continuing to ask yourself, and then what would happen? And then what would happen? Until you get to, you know, the final place. And then ask yourself, well, could I live with that? Like, and most likely the answer is yes, I could live with that. May not be super fun, but it's not as horrible as I'm making it to be in my mind. So we also need to be aware of our thoughts, and there's scripture that tells us about this. In Romans 12, it says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It also says, I think, in Colossians, to take every thought captive for Christ. So God knows that our thoughts have a direct correlation to our spiritual state, to our emotional state. And so I think there's a reason why there's a lot of scriptures about our thoughts and our thinking. And like I referenced before in Philippians, it says, you know, to focus your mind on these things, the things that are good, noble, true. So there's power in where we direct our thoughts and where we focus our thoughts. So we need to be aware of our thoughts and to be aware of how those thoughts impact us. So many of our thoughts are distorted. We have thousands of thoughts going through our minds every minute. So it makes sense that some of them would be a little off, right? Or not completely true. That's like just by sheer numbers, we're going to have some untrue thoughts coming into our minds. So I'm going to share this concept with you. It's from a form of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive being the way we think. So from this model, from this perspective, they say that our feelings actually don't come from events that we experience. Our feelings actually come from our perception or our belief about that event. So let me give you an example. So you and I could have the exact same experience. Let's say we're driving in traffic and someone cuts me off. And my thought is that person's just a jerk. So what feelings might I have if that's my belief? He's a jerk. Anger. Yeah, everyone's like, anger. Yeah, I might honk my horn. I might be like, ah.
Sign language.
There might be some sign language. I don't know. So if my belief is like that person's just a jerk, they think like the world revolves around them, they're entitled, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, that's going to bring anger and frustration, which doesn't really feel very good. So what if someone cuts me off and my thought is like, oh, they probably didn't realize that that lane ended, and like, oh, they weren't really paying attention. What might I feel if that was my thought? Oh well, yeah, I might be a little annoyed because it's an annoying situation, but my reaction will probably not be as intense, right? I'd be like, okay. So same with, you know, you all were listening to our speaker this morning. I might have perceived something, and I didn't get to listen to the whole thing, so I can't do anything specific, but let's say we're all listening to the same speaker, and I believe that this speaker is really authoritarian and kind of controlling and intense. So I might feel kind of like, I don't want to do what he says. But maybe you're like, no, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he's like really confident. So you might be like, oh, the feeling might be like, yeah, I totally trust this person. So again, we can sit in the same sermon, in the same class. You all might be, it'd be interesting to compare notes with, if you're here with someone like, oh, what did you feel about that? And I've totally experienced that too, where someone's like, oh, I didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. And another person's like, oh, well, I thought it was great. I totally didn't see it that way. So it's really important for us to be aware that perception is everything, and our perception is not always accurate. There's a saying in this form of therapy, don't believe everything you think. It's not always true. And there's different reasons for this. I use this picture of, we all develop a lens that we view the world through. And that lens gets there from different things that we learn, different things we experience. And so just like if you're wearing glasses and there are some splotches on them, it's going to distort your vision. It's going to distort the way you perceive things. And so what we do in cognitive behavioral therapy is we focus on this. Because we often do not have control over events, right? We often do not have control over what exactly happens to us. We have some control to some degree, but not complete control. And, you know, we do have some control over our feelings, but they're a lot more automatic. So the area that we really have the most control is our beliefs or the way we think about things. So often, if for you your anxiety is fueled by anxious thoughts, I would tell you, okay, let's say those thoughts out loud. And then what we would do when you are able to become aware of what you are thinking, then we can say, well, is that true? Or how true is that? A lot of times our anxious thoughts, there's like a grain of truth in it, and that's what makes it hard to totally discount it, because it's not a complete lie. But you can say like, okay, maybe this is only like 10% true. Maybe I'm giving this a lot more weight than it actually warrants or deserves. So we challenge those thoughts. So if I have a thought of like, my fiance's in law enforcement, so if I haven't heard from him in a couple hours when he's on shift, my mind might go like, he's dead, you know? And it's like, okay, he could be, but are there any alternative reasons for why you haven't heard from him for 2 hours? He might be on a call. He might be in the part of the county where there's no cell reception. He might just be busy. Sometimes he has really busy days. And so again, when you have an anxious or worried thought, saying like, well, is there any alternative reason? Again, like if you are at work and you see your coworker in the hall and you say like, hey, how's it going? And they just like keep walking and don't acknowledge you. You could assume that they just hate you and that they don't like you. Or you could say like, huh, again, being curious. Okay, something's going on for them. Like maybe they didn't hear me. Maybe they didn't sleep well last night. Oh yeah, he has a new baby. He probably didn't sleep at all. He's probably a walking zombie. Like, you know, when you start actually thinking logically, what are other reasons for what just happened? We can make our thoughts more accurate. And another thing sometimes I have people do is if it is like a relational thing, like you're not sure, like the way someone reacted to you or talked to you, if it feels safe, I have people check it out. And I have couples do this a lot, because we can assume something about our significant other. We can react more quickly with our significant other because of the history we have, because of previous experiences with them. So actually saying like, hey, when you said that, like, it felt kind of like you're angry at me, like, are you? And they might be like, actually, yeah, like, thanks for bringing it up, like, and then you can talk about it. But a lot of times people will say, no, I'm not angry at you at all, I have a lot on my mind, so I'm being kind of short with my answers because I'm trying to think through this thing right now. Or I might perceive, you know, someone is ignoring me, but yeah, they're just totally focused on what they're doing, and they can't do both at once. Yes?
So how can you challenge someone else's belief about the event mm-hmm. without them getting defensive? Mm-hmm. So if, you know, a loved one or mm-hmm. friend or colleague has a belief about an event mm-hmm. and they're like totally, you know, their mm-hmm. feelings are ramped up and then they, you know, take it. How can you challenge someone's mm-hmm.
Yeah, without being right, like that. Yeah, well, I always say if someone's really, really ticked off, you know, and I'll get into this when I talk about trauma, when we are really emotionally heightened, the logical part of our brain shuts down. So also a good note for married couples is when you guys are really, really upset, probably no constructive conversation's gonna happen in that time. So for real, timeouts are good. And not just a 10-minute timeout, like a 45-minute to an hour timeout, because that's how long it takes for our nervous system to go back to neutral if it's, you know, really heightened. So that would be the first thing I'd say is assess where someone's is. Are they open? Can they be receptive? And I often start, like if it's a client sitting in my office, I start with empathy. I can say like, whoa, this is really ticking you off. Like this has really upset you. And they're like, yeah, I'm so upset. And so first I acknowledge it and, you know, don't shame them for having those feelings. And then if I have good rapport with them, like I probably wouldn't do this on my first session with someone, but I would say like, hey, so what are the thoughts behind that you know, behind your anger or behind this hurt? Like, what are you thinking about yourself or the situation that you think might be causing you to feel this way? So I ask them to identify the thoughts. So they might be like, well, that he doesn't care about me, that this is more important than our relationship, or that blah, blah, blah. You know, so then I have them say it out loud. And then sometimes when they're just saying it out loud, they're like, oh. Or they even, a lot of people say, oh, now that I'm saying it out loud, this sounds crazy. And it's like, and I just say, that's okay. It's in your head, so let's give it some attention. And if they're saying it and it's still, they're not really self-aware, then I'll say like, okay, like how do you know? How do you know that he doesn't care about you? Or how do you know that person meant to slight you? And then again, they share. And then I might gently ask, okay, so it sounds like there's some evidence for it. Do you see any evidence against that? Do you see any alternatives? So just asking questions, but not with an agenda to like force them to see truth. Because, yeah, that will bring defensiveness. So, in short, I'd say start with empathizing, acknowledging the feelings, and then just being curious, like I said. So, yeah, what are the thoughts? What are you thinking about yourself, or what are you thinking about the situation? And then how is that true, or how do you know? Like, what's your evidence for that thought? Are there any alternatives? So you can totally use this with other people. And it helps for me because I usually share this concept with people ahead of time. So when I start asking them these questions, they're not like, what the heck is this? Like, they know. They know what I'm getting at. And it's always done, again, in a very non-judgmental way. I usually tell people, all of us have distorted thinking. Every person in this room has distorted thinking. I have distorted thinking. So that it's not like you're a weirdo or you're messed up. It's like, you're a human, and this is a thing that humans do sometimes. So, does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah, that's
great. Awesome. Yes?
Add one, there's so many different ways to play out, but if they're reacting to something you said or did,
mm-hmm.
I think something in my field that we call intention stating.
Mm.
Stating what your intention or your purpose was to try to help clarify.
Yes.
And say, well, I see you reacting a certain way. What I was trying to address or what my intention was, mm-hmm.
Totally.
The
yes. And yeah, this can be so great if it is someone who's coming to you to check it out, like, hey, I felt really like belittled by that. It's like, oh, like, and you can own that, say like, I'm really sorry, that wasn't my intention. This is what I was meaning. You know, and if you can be open and receptive to that, then it can be a really constructive conversation and you can learn like, oh, this communication style doesn't work so great with this person. And again, this comes up a lot. For me, it's come up the most with my fiance, where he thinks he's being helpful to me, but it actually increases my anxiety. He would, early on, when we would talk about our wedding, he'd be like, well, we'll figure it out. And I'd be like, well, no, like, what you're saying is I'm gonna figure it out. And I've had a lot of experiences where, like, yeah, I've worked with people and they're like, well, we'll figure it out. But it's like, no, you're like, it'll work out. But it's like, you just think that because you don't see me doing it and making it happen. And so I told him that. I was like, you know, when you say that to me, it just feels like you're minimizing how big this is. And it makes me feel super alone because it makes me think that you don't really get it. You don't get what this is going to take. And he was like, oh. He's like, what I'm trying to do, my intention, is to calm you down by reminding you, like, it's gonna be okay, and we're gonna figure it out. And I was like, okay, so his intention was to support me, and it had the opposite effect. And again, that could be like a male-female difference as well. But again, we all perceive things really differently, so it's so great when you're going into a conversation with someone, especially if it could be conflictual, is to not assume that that person thinks what you think. Assuming just really and mind reading really deteriorates a lot of good conversations and a lot of relationships. So it's good to catch yourself if you're assuming that this person knows that you meant them no harm. Like, they may not know that. That may not be their basic assumption. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Our intentions do matter, but they're not always seen because people can't read our minds. Not yet. Google hasn't come up with that technology. So, okay. So again, what is so great is we do have control over our thoughts and our attitudes. So if you guys would be willing to look at your thoughts next time you notice a really strong emotional reaction, to just be curious and to say, okay, what am I believing about what just happened? And is that contributing to this feeling at all? And sometimes your belief and your feelings and reactions are totally valid. Like, bad things happen. Like, if someone screams at me, I have a right to be upset about that. Like, again, they might have all their stuff going on, but it doesn't change the fact of, like, that was scary, that was hurtful, and I'm not really happy with that person right now. So, I mean, I could still say, like, I could still maybe address some of my beliefs about that situation, but there are certain situations where it's like, yeah, it is bad, it is awful. So I hope, my hope is that you don't leave here being like, none of my feelings are valid. Like, no, they are valid. But sometimes they might be intensified or influenced by thoughts or beliefs that are not completely accurate. So if we can adjust our beliefs to be more accurate, then we don't have to add to our suffering. Life's hard enough. We don't need these extra negative thoughts on top of it to make life harder. Yes?
Well, I was going to ask, is there like a way, I don't know if this question makes much sense, but like a way to change your belief about the event? You know, like every time we hear people talk about positivity, it's like, you gotta smile and be a care girl.
Nope. That's not how I roll.
But yeah, so like, let's say someone does cut you off, and your belief is that you know, obviously this would be kind of ridiculous, especially with someone you don't know, but they don't like me, they just don't get angry about it. Is there a way to change that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So using a lot of the things I've already talked about, but then also being aware of, we all have automatic negative thoughts, and we all have what they call negative core beliefs. So, like, kind of taking it a step beneath, like, just dealing with things one by one as they come up, is being aware, what are my negative core beliefs? Like, what are the things that I believe about myself that are really hurtful to me and that really are, like, raw spots? Like, if they get poked, I'm like, ah! And so a really common one is, I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I'm unlovable. I can't do anything right. These are a lot of common negative core beliefs. Because I just think in your example, like, if that's your immediate thought, you probably have a negative core belief of, like, I'm unlovable, I'm unworthy. And so that's part of that lens that I was talking about. So you can take it a step further and become aware of, what are my negative core beliefs, and to work on challenging those in a bigger sense. And something that I've done and that I've had clients do is actually write out those negative core beliefs and look in scripture and see, what does God say about me? Because scripture is full of God declaring his love for us. And that it's like, yeah, we aren't perfect and he loves us anyway. So we are, to God, we are worthy of love. To God, we are valuable. And so I have people actually write scriptures that say that, and actually say out loud, you know, I renounce the lie that I have no value, and I choose to believe that I am valuable because God created me and has a purpose for me. So, and that's really powerful, saying that out loud. So that's like a deeper, that's a step deeper than what I was talking about before, but absolutely, you're still challenging. And then you get to the point to where you don't interpret everything as someone hating you, right? Because if your belief is like, I suck, no one likes me, I'm unlovable, you are going to interpret things in that, you know, in that path more easily and more readily. So that would be taking it a step further. But again, in the moment, you could also just catch yourself and be like, okay, is that really true that this person doesn't like me? Like, they don't even know me, so that, okay, you know, so you just challenge the belief like that. And again, I've had situations where I know what I'm believing isn't true, and I still have the difficult feeling. And sometimes I have people in my life who are supportive, who I can be totally honest with. So I've actually called friends and been like, okay, I am believing something that's not true, and I know it's not true, but it feels really true. And so sometimes I have to phone a friend, be like, can you also tell me that this isn't true? Because my brain isn't enough right now. So also getting support as you're working on becoming more aware of your thoughts and working on changing them. So sometimes we need that outside opinion, that outside voice to tell us, you know, to be like, yes, you are not crazy. This is actually, like, not a real thing. Or to give you their perspective of like, well, no, I think that person really likes you. Like, and then they can give you all their reasons why. So does that kind of address your question?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for asking. Yes?
Looking at this, sometimes I get this, like, eye twitch thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's like when I'm just sitting and playing video games, I just think to myself, I'm like, I do try to be, like, the positive, you know, thing where I go worst-case scenario. Like, and I literally am saying out loud to myself, I'm fine. I'm really actually good. You know, she bought me dinner, smells really good, played video games. My son's, you know, doing great. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's so weird.
Yeah.
And it went away for a while I was doing Taekwondo. And honestly, it hasn't come back since I've arrived here at camp. And it seems weird, but I just don't want it to be conditional on places I go. Like,
sure.
I kind of would just like to be okay all the time.
Yes.
If you can't name the belief about the event, or you can't do the thing where you go worst case scenario,
yes. So I'm actually going to get into, because that's more of like a physiological manifestation of anxiety. Or that's how you're interpreting that, right?
I guess. Or, yeah.
Like possibly. And I love you're being really curious about it.
Doctor said it's,
it could be stress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got that part checked out.
Okay. So I would say, again, like you're being curious and you're noticing when it's gone away. So it's like, oh, doing Taekwondo, it wasn't happening then. So there could be a physical component to it, excuse me. You know, exercising burns off the stress hormone cortisol. So, and cortisol is what makes us like ready to fight or flee. And so it could be that when you're exercising, you're burning off that cortisol and your eye twitch doesn't happen. So it could have that more physical thing. And so I will pause and I'll continue on, and you might get your question answered as I talk about, but thank you for sharing. Yeah, so we're talking about our thoughts and you bring up, but what if this doesn't work? Which is what I said in my intro. Like, okay, the Bible tells us, like, talk to God about what we're worried about, like, process it with him, remember his promises. And that can be so powerful, but it doesn't always work. And sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes it's because either it's a physical issue or we are having a trauma reaction. And so again, to define my terms, when we think of trauma, we can often be like, whoa, well, that's super intense. I don't have trauma. Yes, you do. I'm sorry. You're a human. Life is hard. We live in a broken world. But trauma, it doesn't just mean a veteran who has PTSD. It doesn't just mean a kid who grew up in a physically abusive home. I call it little T traumas and big T traumas. We can have what they call developmental trauma, where, yeah, maybe your parents didn't physically harm you, but maybe your parent was really critical and criticized everything you did and never praised you. That is developmental trauma that kind of builds up slowly over time, and it impacts the way we view ourselves. So this definition of trauma, which that word comes from the Greek word for wound, which, again, we can, like, have a head trauma, right, or there's trauma center at the hospital, but I'm talking, obviously, about an emotional, psychological wound. And trauma is simply a distressing experience that changes one's view of themselves and the world around them. So again, if we think of that lens, trauma is a big dark spot. It really changes the way we view ourselves and others. And the reason why, if this is the basis of your anxiety and just changing your thinking may not work, is that trauma actually changes how our brains function. And it affects the parts of the brain that are not involved with our logic. And the cognitive behavioral stuff, that is complete logic, right? You're reasoning with yourself. And so this is a picture that represents what they call triune brain theory, and it's the idea that we actually have three brains in one. So we have our neocortex, which is on the top, and that's our rational thinking brain. That's what really sets us apart from animals. We have our limbic brain, also called the mammalian brain, which is where our emotions lie, and a part called the amygdala, which kind of sounds the alarm when it perceives any threats in your environment. And then we have our reptilian brain, which that's our instinctual automatic function brain. So, you know, you can't tell your heart to stop beating, right? It's because it's just automatically happening. And so trauma affects the limbic and the reptilian brain. So this part that doesn't really respond to logic. So if you've had a traumatic experience where you've learned something about yourself or the world, so maybe it's out of nowhere, you get mugged on the sidewalk. And that experience teaches you, like, I never know when something's going to happen. The world is not safe. Even if you tell yourself, like, I'm safe, you might start feeling anxious when you're home and you've checked all the locks 50 times and you're like, I'm secure, I'm safe. But your what we call lower brain is not listening to that logic. It's you're still feeling anxious. A lot of times, so anxiety is a normal response, actually, to an abnormal situation. How people react to trauma, that is a normal response to an abnormal situation. So again, people can say, I feel crazy, I feel this, I feel that, and I'm like, I'd be concerned if you weren't reacting this way. Like when someone has had something horrible happen to them and they have no emotional reaction, that's when I'm concerned. That's when I'm like, okay. And that's okay, because we can work with that, so it's not like they're broken beyond repair or anything like that. But just to be aware that anxiety is a normal response to an abnormal situation. So what happens a lot of times for people when they get anxiety and they're like, but I'm totally fine, and sometimes it's only physiological and they have no idea what triggered it or what the deal is, it could be because when we have a difficult experience, a traumatic experience, our lower brain, so that limbic brain, that reptilian brain, it takes in all the sensory information. And so then we're just chilling out. So I use the example of getting mugged on the street. Let's say you're around the corner from a Chinese food restaurant when that happened. You're not consciously aware that you're smelling Chinese food, but you are. And then maybe a month later, you're walking down the street, you smell Chinese food, you start to shake, your hands get clammy, your heart rate increases, and you have no idea why. So what's happening is that alarm system in your brain, the amygdala, is saying, oh my gosh, it's happening again. It's perceiving something that's similar to that traumatic experience and telling you, it's happening again, you need to run away, you need to get safe. And so if you are actually in a threatening situation, again, this is super helpful. This can be great to help you to know, like, yeah, I need to make myself safe. But if you are actually fine, if you are actually safe, this can be really difficult because your whole nervous system is going into fight or flight or freeze, as that happens as well. And you don't know why, and you're like, what is wrong with me? And there's a good chance that the more subconscious parts of your brain are perceiving stuff in your environment beyond your conscious awareness, that's reminding them of a trauma. So a lot of times if I have a client and they know that they have trauma, the first step we'll take is, okay, what are the triggers? What are the reminders? And sometimes it's very specific. Sometimes it doesn't seem to make sense to them at first, and then as we explore, it does make sense. So again, to be curious, not judgmental. So I say the amygdala is kind of like that overly helpful friend who's not actually helpful. Like if you've had a friend who's like, let me come clean your house for you, but they like are pretty bad at cleaning actually, so you just have to go and they actually like make more mess. So the amygdala, like, it's so important. It helps us survive, but it doesn't always perceive things correctly. So that can be a reason why we have anxiety and why just simply addressing our thoughts may not help. And trauma, again, it changes our brain. It makes these parts of the brain and our nervous system more on edge. So we perceive danger more. And so it can have this cumulative effect. And so I share this just to normalize that and to, again, take away shame. Because then people are like, what's wrong with me? And I also want you to know that this doesn't mean, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Absolutely, there are things you can do about it. And that's a lot of what I do as a therapist, is I have tons of clients who have trauma, and it's giving them panic attacks and anxiety. I just want to share this quote, because he says it better than I do. This is from Bessel van der Kolk, and he has probably one of the best more recent books on trauma and how to treat trauma. It's called The Body Keeps the Score, and he's a psychiatrist, and he's done tons of research on trauma, done like what's happening in the brain. It's helping us understand it so much better. It's helping us understand why do people re-experience, why do people have flashbacks. So that book is amazing. But he says, from my vantage point as a researcher, we know that the impact of trauma is upon the survival or animal part of the brain. That means that our automatic danger signals are disturbed, and we become hyper or hypoactive, aroused or numbed out. We become like frightened animals. We cannot reason ourselves out of being frightened or upset. It is only partly an issue of consciousness. Much has to do with unconscious parts of the brain that keep interpreting the world as being dangerous and frightening and feeling helpless. You know you shouldn't feel that way, but you do, and that makes you feel defective and ashamed. So I just think his explanation is so spot on. If you don't understand how your brain works and how it responds to trauma, you will feel defective and damaged and ashamed. And so if any of this resonates for you, I hope that you can leave here knowing, like, you're not a weirdo. You are responding normally to an abnormal situation. I say the same thing about grief. When someone has gone through a horrible loss, I say, your grief is a normal response to an abnormal situation. So again, I hope that you can give yourself some more grace if you think this could be happening for you. And again, to expand your idea of what trauma is, you don't have to have lived through a natural disaster or a terrorist attack or extreme physical or sexual abuse to have trauma. It could be these small little things. It could be my mom forgot to pick me up all the time, so I never really feel like I can trust, or I never really feel secure. Yes?
Just one quick question. Mm-hmm. What are your views on psychiatric medications to treat anxiety? Do you think that aligns with biblically?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have to preface that with I'm not a medical professional, so I can't give like advice on whether someone should take meds or not. But I would also say, well, what's the basis of your anxiety? If it's trauma, the meds probably won't be that helpful. If it is a chemical imbalance in your brain and the medication addresses that, then it could be very helpful. And for any psychological ailment, whether it's anxiety, depression, if its basis is organic, is physical, I don't view it any differently than any other medical issue. And again, like to try to take some of that stigma, because people get anxiety, people get depressed because their neurotransmitters in their brain are off. And it's like someone has diabetes because their blood sugar levels are off. So in those cases where I think it might be a biological thing, I will refer clients to a psychiatrist and see if medication will help. I personally think it's not an end. I think it's a means to an end. And a great metaphor that I heard another therapist use is, you know, if you're kind of in a pit and there's a ladder but you can't reach it, medication kind of lowers the ladder for you. So you can grab it, but you still have to pull yourself out. So I think medication can be helpful, and but again, it's like, well, what is the basis of the psychological issue you're experiencing? And are you just trying to slap a Band-Aid on it and not actually deal with the issue? There's no miracle pill. Like there's no drug that will perfectly heal everything. But I think sometimes it can be that little boost that someone needs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Can you speak a little bit about postpartum anxiety? Do you feel like that's more trauma-based or biological-based or more?
I think it can totally be both. because, I mean, I've never had children. My best friend just had a baby, though. And your hormones are all over the place. So, yeah, your biology is so off. So I think it can totally just be a hormonal thing. And depending on your birth experience, it could be traumatic. Like if your baby had to go to the NICU, if there are some really scary parts, it could totally be trauma-based too. So I think it depends on your birth experience. But yeah, I usually tell women who are postpartum, like, be nice to yourself. Like your body doesn't know what's happening. It just went through this crazy transition. So but that's a great question. So I know I have to wrap this up, and I'm sure there's so many more questions, so I'll be up here for a bit. But I do want to say sometimes it's hard to discern. Is my anxiety just my thoughts, or is it biological? Is it trauma-based? So again, I invite you to be curious about that. And maybe you start with doing the work with your thoughts, and if that's not working, maybe it's time for there to be some deeper exploration. And I will say that for trauma, there are very specific treatments for trauma. And I can't explain them all to you, but I can list a few. One is called EMDR, which I do that. There's a newer one called brain spotting. There's somatic therapy, which is engaging your body more. Trauma affects those more primitive parts of it. It affects our body, so actually engaging your body can be really healing for trauma. And then a lot of people use expressive arts. I do that a lot. So there are ways to deal with the trauma, to deal with the unconscious material and to bring it into our conscious and to heal it. So I want you to hear that there is definitely hope, and there are definitely things you can do if this is what's going on for you. And I would also say that we might try to solve our anxiety. We might try to just push it down. It's there, but feelings demand to be felt. And I found in my experience that when we don't give our emotions a voice, find another way to come out that's usually more and less helpful. So if you know that you're having a hard time with anxiety, I encourage and invite you to acknowledge it. And that's the first step. And to also remember that we ultimately have reassurance in Christ. That if we're believers, we know that God will make all things right in his time. And it doesn't mean that nothing bad will ever happen to us, but it means that even when bad things happen, we can trust that we will be okay. And that's such a gift that comes with our faith. And we know that our souls are secure with him. We know that he can give us what we need to recover. Traumas. He understands us. He knows why we're going through what we're going through. And so I think it's such a gift that we can rest in all those promises. And so again, as you leave, just remember that your anxiety is not necessarily a sin issue to repent of, but it could be a wound that needs Jesus healing. And so I hope you can leave here feeling empowered, feeling like you have more understanding of what's going on for you or your loved one. I will stand up here for a few minutes, but thank you so much for being an amazing group and asking great questions. Enjoy the rest of your day.